You're guinea pigs this afternoon. I have to tell you, I'm trying with you some thoughts on the subject of love for enemy in the context of US-USSR relationships. And I've not really done this before. And if it seems to work here, I may use the same material at a presentation I have to make on that subject at the ALCW, ALC Women National Gathering in Detroit in 2 weeks. And I haven't written it yet. So this is raw material. We'll see how it goes. And you may be able to contribute to what finally comes out at Detroit by helping to shape it. I'm of the persuasion that we have a well-developed theology of love for enemy, particularly in terms of international politics. We do not have such a theology. And it's therefore an area that needs work. You can't even find much written on it. That is much application of the words of Jesus to international geopolitics. There's quite a bit on interpersonal relations, love for the one who hates you or dislikes you or wishes you ill in more intimate contexts. But in terms of internation affairs, there just isn't much around on the subject. So that's what we're going to try to address this afternoon. I don't know if you can see the board. The writing instruments don't write very well anymore. It isn't all that important. It's just an outline of what I propose to do, and I'll tell you what's there. Part one, some discussion of the term and concept of enemy, which is defined as the hated one we are to love. Secondly, some reflections on the current enmity between the two superpowers. What's that like, and how does it get to be the way it is? And thirdly, the call to Christians in one of the two superpowers, namely us. What are some things we can do about it, about that relationship and trying to improve the relationship? So I begin with a reading of Matthew 5, a few of the verses in Matthew 5 from our Lord. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you salute only your brethren, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? These words are difficult enough even when we try applying them in interpersonal relations. How can they possibly be applied to relations between nations, between superpowers in a nuclear age? Or should they be? Well, I'm going to suggest that they should be and can be, and that there are certain implications of that for us. In the conviction that Jesus meant to include no one, no potential or real enemy, let's reflect on the possible significance of these words from Matthew 5 for believers in the United States in this moment, as we consider especially our relationship with the Soviet Union and its people. First, some thoughts on the word enemy and the nature of enmity in general. The word enemy comes from the Latin inimicus, not amicus, not friend. In German, the word is der Feind, which we have also in English, the hating one. In Greek, it means hated one. So Jesus is really asking his disciples to love those we hate. Now, the concept of enemy has no organic reality, no objective content. That is, outside of another person's perception, an enemy does not exist. Think about that a little bit. You can be my enemy only if I perceive you to be such. If I do not see you as enemy, there's no way you can be my enemy. Thus, in one respect, I create my enemies in my own mind. In a sense, then, it is easy to change the enemy status of another. Simply decide that they are no longer your enemy. And history has many examples of that. For instance, the Japanese, the Germans, in my lifetime and that of many of you, the Chinese were once our national enemies. They are no longer. And the change from enemy to not enemy was really quite rapid. To go farther back, the British, the Mexicans, the Spanish were all at one time our national enemies. It's easier, apparently, to lose your enemy of the U.S. status if you lose a war to the U.S. That's the quickest way to lose your status as an enemy of the United States. But it's not always a requirement. The Chinese have gone from enemy to friend in a rather short time without losing a war to us. And I think chiefly because of a change in the mindset of us. The Chinese, perhaps to some degree also, but I think the primary change that caused that shift from enemy to friend was in us and in the mind of perhaps one person, Richard Nixon. It is also true that the enemy I seek to love is not by my loving compelled to change. That is, if I decide you're no longer my enemy, that change occurs in my mind, but it doesn't necessarily change your behavior. You may still be hostile to me. Your mean and hostile behavior can continue, though I really believe in relations among persons and among nations, it is rare for the hostility to continue long when one party stops treating the other as enemy. It is very difficult for enmity to continue as a one-sided activity. It simply is so. And I think you can look again at the U.S.-Chinese relationship for proof of that. For Jesus, love of enemy is extraordinary behavior. It is unnatural behavior. It is not the way human beings normally are. And so he says, it is the more. In what more are you doing than others? Even tax collectors and pagans love those who return their love. By the way, have you ever thought about how it must be to be a tax collector and read all those words in the Bible about how awful tax... They're always used as the illustration of the worst possible behavior. We got it again last night with Zacchaeus. That's no great accomplishment, to love those who return your love. But loving those who don't return your love, that is considered, viewed by Jesus, as something of an achievement. And it's the kind of ethical behavior that's expected of his followers. Charles McCarthy, a Roman Catholic theologian of our day, says, love of enemy makes no sense in rational ethics. But because of God's love in Christ, no one, no enemy, can threaten my survival. Therefore, I have no need of an enemy. McCarthy is speaking, of course, in terms of ultimate survival. In Christ, our security is assured ultimately, and so we have no need of enemy in any ultimate sense. There's no place for enemy because no one can ultimately destroy us. Part of the problem in international enemy loving, of course, is that not all citizens of this nation are trying to follow Jesus' injunction. Not all feel obliged even to consider Jesus' words. And many Christians who do take them seriously in certain settings, interpersonal relations, are not prepared to apply them to relations between nations. So those believers would say they don't apply to the international political realm. Indeed, many believers are inclined to go to another extreme by theologizing our national adversaries. That is, we are tempted to make them God's enemies. We not only don't love them and try to change the relationship from enemy to non-enemy, we elevate their status of enemy into enemies of God himself. We call them godless. We use biblical analogies in which we, of course, take the role of Israel, God's chosen people. And our adversaries are therefore on the side of Satan. But to use the Bible in this way is highly suspect. In fact, biblically, God often uses the national enemies of Israel to correct Israel. That should give us pause in the United States and cause for reflection whenever we're tempted to make our national enemies into the enemies of God. Well, in the second place, what about the current enmity between us and the Soviet Union? What can we say about the application of these words to that relationship? I think there are few who would dispute that our relationship is at one of its most dangerous, least constructive points of the last 40 years. It is the stance of our political and military leadership, and of vast millions of U.S. citizens who agree with that stance, an accurate one. Listen first to a longtime student of the Soviet Union and former ambassador to Moscow, George Kennan. I think one of the more perceptive observers of our relationship over these last 40 years. And I suppose I say that because I tend to agree with him. But I commend him to you, whether or not you like what he says. I think he is thoughtful. He is one of our premier Sovietologists. In November 1981, a little over 2.5 years ago, he said this: "I find the view of the Soviet Union that prevails today in large portions of our governmental and journalistic establishments so extreme, so subjective, so far removed from what any sober scrutiny of external reality would reveal, that it is not only ineffective, but dangerous as a guide to political action. We shall not be able to turn this military and nuclear rivalry around until we learn to correct these childish distortions. Above all, we must learn to see the behavior of the leadership of that country, the Soviet Union, as partly the reflection of our own treatment of it." End of quotation from Kennan. Well, I tell you that I don't like to think of the Soviet people as my enemy, certainly not the Soviet people, and yet we are all programmed to think that way. And there is, for me, truth in the statement that the two nations are adversaries. We are competitors. We are the two dominant economic, political, and military forces in today's world. We are the two prime promoters of political and economic systems which are, around the world, in genuine conflict. We seek to perpetuate values which are not harmonious. Yet all of this disharmony does not make it necessary for us to believe that the evil and the error is all on one side. Partly it is the Messiah complex, which our nation has had from its beginnings, that leads us to identify ourselves totally with righteousness, and any enemy we have totally with evil. President Reagan's words of a year ago, calling the USSR the focus of evil in the world today and an evil empire, these words come naturally to many U.S. politicians and even to some U.S. preachers. It is not that the Soviets do not behave in evil ways. They do, but so do we. Ask the Mexicans of the 1830s, the Guatemalans of the 1950s, the Chileans of the 1970s, the Nicaraguans of the 1980s. I don't consider it very fruitful to debate which of the two powerful nations is the greater perpetuator of evil during the past four decades. Much of the rest of the world considers us both equally to blame for the nuclear dilemma and the massive militarization of the entire planet. The point is not who is more evil. The point is, as Christians, we know the depth of collective sin in all peoples and in all systems. To avoid bearing false witness, therefore, we must say, not all the evil is in our adversary, and not all in our adversary is evil. Another central fact about our relationship is that we don't understand each other very well. It's probably true, because our system is so much more open, that the Soviets understand us a lot better than we do them. But one statistic of this kind of imbalance which exists, and I think it is an imbalance, one statistic is very revealing. There are more teachers of English in the Soviet Union than there are students of Russian in the United States. They have more teachers of our language than we have of all people studying their language. We don't understand the history of the Soviet Union, and thus we have little feeling for its fear of us. And it does have a fear of us. It's paranoia about things that are not Russian. We find it very difficult to put ourselves in their shoes. To recognize, for instance, that the USSR is the only communist state in the world surrounded by hostile communist powers. Have you ever thought of that? It's the only communist state in the world surrounded by hostile communist powers, from China through Poland. Or that all of the nuclear weapons of the world, not controlled by the Soviet Union, are aimed at the Soviet Union. All of the nuclear weapons in the world, not controlled by them, are aimed at them. That'll give you a little dose of paranoia. Or that the Soviet Union insists on maintaining a ring of buffer nations at its borders because of 1,000 years of invasions, usually from Europe and the West. We don't understand that very well. Or that in this century, the Soviet Union has lost, estimates vary, some say as many as 70 million people because of wars. First their own revolution, then World War I, then World War II. And of course the purges of Stalin would come in there too. Those were Soviets killing Soviets. Whereas the United States has not had a war on its land since the Civil War 120 years ago. Or that the Soviet Union really believes the United States is capable of landing troops on its soil, because we did it once before. We did it in 1919, a fact that most U.S. citizens have never heard of. They weren't there long, and there wasn't a lot of fighting, but we landed troops in the north at Archangel, along with the British, right after World War I. Or, we don't understand very well either, that the Soviet Union has a centuries-long inferiority complex and identity problem, always trying to catch up with the West and the rest of the world. And there's irony in all of this lack of understanding, because in many respects the US and the USSR are very similar. To external observers, particular people outside both countries, we are viewed as more alike than unlike, and both are viewed as a threat to the world's peace. Let me list some of the common factors. One, we share superpower status, of course, and a commitment to escalation in nuclear weaponry. At least we're both contributing to it. Two, we are both convinced of a messianic role. The US has always viewed itself as a kind of divine darling. The USSR for centuries has viewed itself as the holy motherland. Moscow in the old days before the revolution was viewed as the third Rome, the heir after Rome and Constantinople, then the center of Christian civilization moved to Moscow. And some of that is still there in the Russian people. Both seek to impose their influence on the rest of the world and to reshape the world in their own image. Both, coming out of centuries of isolationism, today have become interventionist around the world. And both ignore the non-proliferation commitments of the nuclear treaties that both have signed. We're both breaking them. And we stand together on one point against the rest of the world, that the non-nuclear states remain non-nuclear. From the perspective of biblical faith also, both share some characteristics. I have three. Both pursue in their economic systems an idolatry of material success. We are more alike than we are different, I think, in our understanding of the centrality of economic factors. We tend to forget how many underlying assumptions Marxism and capitalism really share. Two, both of us count on military prowess to make ourselves secure. And three, both find it impossible to confess sin, to admit mistakes before the world, and to ask the community of nations for forgiveness. I don't know if that's unique to the US and the USSR. Most nations have not been very good at confessing sin. But it seems to me that our two in particular have great difficulty admitting mistakes. I should add that both have large populations of believers, Christians, but also Jews, and in the Soviet Union, large numbers of Muslims. We two countries have the largest number of adherents to Christianity of any nations except Brazil. The Russian Orthodox Church alone is larger in membership than all of the National Council of Churches member communions put together in the USA. I will tell you that I believe we in the U.S. still have reason to dislike much about the Soviet system and Soviet behavior. I don't wish to trade it for ours. My hope is that both systems will change toward more humaneness, and I probably would agree that theirs needs to change more than ours. But I do not think that the way to encourage change in them is by the present course we are on. More on that in the final section. I'm also comforted by the knowledge that to love an enemy does not require me to like or approve of all that my adversary is or does. Well, what can Christians in one superpower do then? I have six specifics. The first is to declare a moratorium on all hostile rhetoric. To some extent, this is simply asking that we not violate the commandment against bearing false witness. Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, the West German physicist and philosopher, has talked about the notion of loving one's enemies intelligently. In a paper to the 1980 Conference of European Churches meeting in Madrid on the Helsinki Accords, he said, "Love of our enemies in practice starts with our coming to understand our enemies. Even then, they will probably remain our enemies. We'll continue to fear us and therefore to hate us. But at least we shall then begin to avoid making the gestures which constantly give them the impression that they are justified in fearing and hating us." A similar thought came from Admiral Noel Gaylor, U.S. Navy retired, in a paper to the 1984 impact briefing of the churches in Washington, D.C. This is a national gathering of political activists in the churches. Happens in March every year. This past spring, he said, "I've tried hard to think what would be the mindset of a president or a premier to actually send a nuclear offensive against another country, to kill people by the millions and millions and millions. And it seems to me there would have to be three things in the mind of such a person. First, he would have to regard the people he was going to incinerate as somehow less than human. They would have to be demonized, their human attributes stripped away. Second, he would have to be mortally afraid. And third, he would have to see no alternative to the terrible act he was about to do. I suggest that to get into this frame of mind requires long-term attitude building, and that we are in fact engaged, we and the Russians, in building those attitudes right now. So my first prescription would be to end the intemperate and childish and threatening rhetoric between us." Thus far, Admiral Gaylor. So first, declare a moratorium on hostile rhetoric. Second, we should send deliberate signals of benevolence, of good intentions, as we as a nation. Is there not some way the U.S. could emulate David's intentional signal of kindness to Saul? You remember when the chance to kill Saul was there? I think Saul was sleeping or in a stupor of some kind. David found him. David did not do it, but left a clear sign that he could have. What would be an equivalent for a superpower like ours today? What new kind of power would such a signal have? Not only with our adversary, but among the entire global community of nations. We get back what we give, not only in interpersonal relations, but also in international relations. As George Kennan says, if we insist on demonizing the Soviet leaders, on viewing them as total and incorrigible enemies, consumed only with their fear or hatred of us, and dedicated to nothing but our destruction, that in the end is the way we shall assuredly have them, if for no other reason than that our view of them allows for nothing else, either for them or for us. So there's a real sense in which we get what we give in international relations. And there's a self-fulfilling prophecy about the kind of stance we've been on these last years and the kind of rhetoric we've been embarking and speaking. So, that's a second suggestion, that we send deliberate signals of benevolence. The third is that we define our security in such a way that the security of the Soviet Union is included. Our security is only as good as the Soviet Union believes its security to be, and vice versa. In a nuclear age, the important thing about the security of each nation is what is in the minds of the leaders of each nation. It is more of a psychological than a military problem. Thus, we have no choice but to take the Soviet desire for security just as seriously as we take our own. That means each military bloc must develop and reveal and practice a strategic plan that takes account of the opponent's security. Another way to say it is, arm only in such a way that the adversary can copy us exactly without our feeling threatened by it. That's why I do not think the new talk about space, planning for space warfare or space defense, which we alone would have, is going to contribute to the security of the world. It is going to destabilize, it seems to me. Deterrence theory has always assumed a kind of equilibrium, a kind of harmony, a kind of parity. Another way, we simply do not become more secure in a nuclear age by making the Soviet leaders feel less secure. Even with purely military definitions, security depends for both of us on maintaining a certain level of trust. We say all the time, you can't trust the Soviets. They probably say it about us. We can't be trusted to keep agreements. The fact is that for 35 years, we have trusted each other to remain rational, to do what is in the self-interest of each country, every second of every day, year after year, that they, not by miscalculation or by intention, fire their nukes at us, and vice versa. We trust each other to that extent. And yet, incongruously, at the same time, some among us wish to frighten the hell out of them. I do not think it is rational behavior to try to frighten, in this situation, to frighten your adversary so that irrational behavior may follow. We both depend a great deal on rationality in the White House and in the Kremlin. So that's point three. Define our security in a way that the security of the USSR is included. We either have security together or we don't have it at all. Fourth, we must seek to affirm the humanity of the Soviet people. We can do that by not breaking off travel or trade, by continuing to meet each other in the Olympics. More a symbol, I think, than anything else, but a powerful symbol. By taking advantage of every opportunity for academic and cultural and scientific exchange. We can do it by studying the history and the cultures and the languages of the Soviet Union, including their contemporary literature. Five, specifically as Christians, pursue church-to-church connections. I believe the Christian community bears the major responsibility for breaking down the dividing wall of hostility between the U.S. and the USSR. We are in a better position to do it than any other community of Americans or Soviet people because we are there and we have a sense of the transnational. We identify across borders as part of the same people of God. Can we adapt St. Paul's word in Ephesians 2 so that we can say and believe, Christ is our peace, Russians and Americans. He has made the two one, and in his body of flesh and blood has broken down the enmity, which stood like a dividing wall between us, so as to create out of the two a single new humanity in himself, thereby making peace. Well, we do this, I believe, as the ALC's 1982 mandate for peacemaking suggests, by people-to-people exchanges between countries, actual visits when that's possible, by letter writing between parishes east and west, and that can be set up, by praying for one another in our services of public worship. Lutheran World Federation stands ready to assist us with such contacts. Finally, let us recognize that our hostility is not to communism. This is my belief. You may not share it. I believe our hostility is not to communism, but rather to Soviet expansionism and to what we see as the Soviet threat to our interests in the world. If that is so, it gives me hope, because we have learned to live amicably with the Marxism of Yugoslavia. of China, of certain, excuse me, of certain countries in Africa. I do not think it is Marxism per se that is our enemy or that we fear. I think it is the Soviet Union's particular application of Marxism around the world. We can, I believe, learn to live also with Marxism in the Soviet Union. That will take some changes, both there and here. For it to change, we too must change. Part of the call to love our enemy, I think, is the call to change ourselves. Always remember, as followers of Jesus Christ, we have a mandate to do the extraordinary, the more than the pagans. I would say also more than our political leaders can or will do, more than non-believers. We are called to run the risk of changing ourselves in order that our enemy may change. Luther once said, "My own worst enemy is myself." Thus, if I want to change my enemy, I begin by changing myself, Luther said. Let us get about the job of doing so. Love of enemy does not mean subordination or servility. Be very clear about that. It means accepting our adversaries as sinful beings like ourselves, full of fears and aggression, but also full of hopes, and I would say full of the activity of God, even when they would deny it. We believe God is at work also in those who deny the existence of God. And I think there's biblical support for that. It means knowing not just that God is working through us to change those we call enemy, but that God is also working through our enemies to change us. Okay, let's talk about that. Any of that that you want to pick up on? Anything you want to add to this emerging theology of love for enemy in international affairs? Yes?
Well, I felt a little bit like there was a blurring of loving the Russian people and the system. I was a little bit confused at the time. I think that we should love all people, but we can't really, as Christians, love atheism, you know, which is promoted by the Russian system.
Can we love atheists?
Yes, we can love atheists, but we can't love atheism and be Christian.
I think I would agree with that, and I did want to say, if it didn't come through clearly, I did want to say that I do not think we need to love or like or approve of the system, which is our adversary, in order to love our enemies. I think you're correct that a distinction has to be made there. There's also the distinction between the leaders, the Soviet leaders, I suppose the Communist Party, who are by definition non-theists. To be a member of the Communist Party, you have to be a non-believer in God. I think it's a small percentage of the population, something like 3% or so, but they are clearly in command. There's a distinction between the leadership and the people. And yet it always strikes me as strange that in our enmity against that system, we say, prepared to wipe out millions of the people, not just the leaders. We're prepared to make war, nuclear war, if it comes to that, on the people.
Well, the question is, some of the, like Solzhenitsyn, some of his warnings that he's he's given us is what is the most likely response toward the Soviets? Do they appreciate the conciliatory gestures?
Yeah.
From what I've read of Solzhenitsyn, he doesn't seem to believe that. He thinks, if I understand correctly, that that leads to more insecurity.
Yeah, and I guess I would simply disagree with him on that, and I'd run the risk, I think. I would take the risk of chancing detente again, and maybe Solzhenitsyn would not.
And
yeah.
For whatever you want to say, Richard Nixon is hardly cast as the person who was soft on communists. And yet, his approach to the Soviets was much, much, much more open than what we're dealing with today. He was willing to talk to them in many different areas. We had a space program that had a joint operation. We had cross-cultural exchanges during Richard Nixon's administration, of all people. This is not a person who was soft on communism, whatever you want to say. What his talent might have been was foreign policy, and he was actually approaching it to some extent, some small extent, in what we're talking about here. I think we have taken gigantic steps backwards since that time. Right now, we do not have a forum that we are directly talking to the Russians in any way.
I think we do have a couple of economic discussions, and I've read recently that there are some at the mid-level range on a few different areas. But you know, it was the Russians that walked out of these peace agreements. We would have put missiles in Europe if it wasn't that they were putting more of these SS-20s or whatever it was. And of course, our allies agree on this. We've got to be even in our approach. Look at both sides equally, I think, not just.
I submit that's what this approach is doing. We have never looked at both sides equally. We have only looked at it from our point of view. Think of what Chuck was saying about how the Soviet Union leadership feel. Look at their history. Look at where they were in World War II when they never trusted even their allies in World War II. And they have always been a people that has had difficulty with paranoia and difficulty with insecurity. And now you have the entire world's nuclear weapons that they don't own aimed at them. And we are going to answer that problem, that they feel they have to build more arms to defend themselves, by putting more arms over there. That is just...
They've been building at a much more rapid rate than we have. And one other thing, first, the Soviets under Stalin made an agreement with Hitler to partition Poland, you understand. They did that first. I think that we should love even the 3 to 5% that are communists, you know, but I think that we need to take the warnings of someone like Solzhenitsyn, who lived over there, and is a Russian, and other dissidents. And we need to try to truly understand the mindset of the Russians and make sure that we're not overly criticizing ourselves. I think, of course, we have to, whether you're on the left side or the right side, you have a tendency to look at it a little differently.
Would you suggest that Jane Fonda is an adequate representative of the Soviet people of what the view of America would be in the 1960s? This is somebody who is disaffected. This is somebody who's been kicked out of the country, escaped out of prison. It's hardly the person we're expecting to get a objective viewpoint from. No more than our political prisoners would have an objective viewpoint.
Well, we have to look at it, the whole thing from all sides. I mean, I definitely agree that there are some things that that Reagan has said. I support Reagan. That I think are unfortunate. And of course, if you have a tendency to dislike Reagan's general politics, then you will zero in on those things. And I certainly can't agree with everything that Reagan has said. I think we should do everything we possibly can to communicate with the Soviets. I think this is in our best interest, but we need to be even-handed about it for our own well-being.
Let me ask the group this question and see how we divide on it. I advance the thesis that the threat to us is not communism or Marxism or even atheism. seems to me we get along with atheists elsewhere in the world without having all this terrible tension between us. I think the threat to us that we perceive correctly is Soviet expansionism, linked with strong military power, and they get in our way as we get in their way. Increasingly around the world, our spheres of influence come into conflict. Central America and the Caribbean being one of the most recent, the Middle East being another, the Persian Gulf. I do not think our real problem with them is Marxist communism or atheism. I don't think it is, because we've learned to live with a lot of other Marxists, as evidenced by the Chinese and the Yugoslavs and certain other smaller countries. How many of you think that the real problem is Marxism and atheism? If that is the case, I find great hope in that. Because I don't think their ideology is going to change very easily, nor will ours. But I think their behavior can change, as can ours, in our own self-interest. I think and hope and I guess pray for the day when they and we alike will stop throwing our weight around the way we do, stop intervening all over the world in other people's affairs. We tend to see our intervening as well-intentioned, because we do see ourselves as the good guys. But not all other countries see it as well-intentioned. A lot of them see it as just as nefarious as Soviet interventionism. I think that's the basic problem between us, that we both want to have our way everywhere in the world, and not that, that they have an officially atheist philosophy of life and ideology. The Chinese communists have that too. The other thing, it seems to me on the rhetoric, the reason the rhetoric is important, I think, is If you had a conflict with your neighbor or some relative halfway across the country, and you kept calling that neighbor or relative the embodiment of evil, it seems to me it'd be very difficult to sit down together and work out an agreement to come to some understanding after having thrown that kind of language around. It just, even if we believe it's so, I don't think we ought to say it, because it doesn't lead to the possibility of any kind of diplomatic relationship. You don't talk that way about your partner in diplomacy. You might speak of being adversaries, you might even speak of being enemies, but to call somebody else the embodiment of evil and then expect that person to sit down with you and negotiate a settlement, I think is just naive. I mean, it doesn't even make good sense in terms of international power politics, I don't think. And I think Reagan has backed off from it, frankly. He has not talked that way in the last year. The last time he talked that way was March of 83. When he spoke to the evangelical broadcasters down in Florida. I don't think he's talking that way anymore. Yeah?
I remember a story told by a missionary. I guess it was Africa. I guess our stories of missionaries are always in Africa. But they told about two tribes in a very remote area that lived across a great river from each other. And that when they went into this tribe, they were told about these fierce, horrible people across the way that they could see sometimes on a clear day across the river, and how horrible people they were. They had all the cannibals. I can't remember all the definitions of these people. And they were just the personification of ultimate evil. You know, and they taught their children from the word go. You know, those are the worst people in the world. They were used as threats against children for behavior, modification. You know, they'll send you over there if you don't shape up and that type of thing. Something happened. I can't remember how that the story went, but something happened, an unusual flood or something that caused some of the people to come in contact with each other and discovered that both groups were exactly alike. In fact, there was some offshoot of relationship that had happened back some time before, and that they had developed independently exactly alike. But they had the story on the other side too about how horrible they were, and it was the rhetoric that did that, and they just hated each other, but they really
they were cousins.
I think this on an international level, we could get some sort of grasp of that type of thing.
Yeah.
I don't remember the specifics of it, but I recall reading a book that was pointing out how much the Soviet Union presently is like it was before the revolution, the sense of really nationalism. It carries these, when the czars were there, carries through the same kinds of authoritarian control of the people and all of this. And just reading about that kind of set the a little more in perspective for spirit of the Soviet Union that goes back many, many decades or further. I don't know that history very well, and probably should, but it fits in with that sense that we relate to the, why maybe the Chinese are in as much enemies of the Soviet Union as we are, even though they're all communists. It's a national.
Yeah, there is one school of thought that really believes that, that what we're seeing now in the 20th century is just the latest example of Russian. And then you have to speak of Russian rather than Soviet. Paranoia, fear, great concern about its borders, the sanctity of its borders, and fear of invasion from other countries. They've had 1,000 years of that. And it's now just the secular form of the old Holy Mother Russia syndrome. I think we are alike in that way, that we're both kind of messianic countries. And that was true of the Russian people apparently before the communist takeover, as well as since. Yeah?
Well, I was just thinking, you know, the Russians are an awful lot like the English and the Spanish were a couple hundred years ago. I mean, they're the current colonial power. You know, we didn't, we could have conquered Mexico and Canada years ago. We could have kept the Philippines and Cuba.
We did keep part of Mexico, of course.
Well, we fought part of it. Kept the
well, we took part of it in a war.
Yeah. The independent country of Texas, you know, we conquered, I guess. It depends on how you look at it. But, you know, the Soviets, after the Second World War, for example, they took the northern islands of Japan. They were just right at the last few days of the war. They did this. And, of course, Eastern Europe. And then, of course, recently Afghanistan and so forth. They. You know, there's quite a little difference in our nationalistic outlook and theirs. And I think we've got to be careful about, we have a lot in common, you know, but there's quite a little difference, too. And if we keep dividing things up with the Soviets, and the way we've looked at things and done things, the way they do things, they're going to gradually take over the world, you know, at the rate they're going. I mean, whenever they can, they've got strong communist parties in Italy and in France and in other countries, and if they could take over, and I understand the Communist parties are separate.
Although they don't really control those Western European Communist parties.
If they could, they would.
I think it's true that there are great differences between us, and I tried to say that. I also think from their perspective, again, they view us as having taken over several parts of the world economically, if not militarily, after World War II. They would say, well, you have South Korea, we have North Korea. And we are there with troops. We say we're there for a different reason, but from their perspective, I think always we have to try to see the world as they see it if we're going to try to bridge the gap to some degree. And I don't think we're very good at that, because we tend to see, from their perspective, always the worst. I mean, when we look at what their behavior is, it's always the worst example, or the worst motivation. And when we look at our behavior, it's always the best motivation. And if we can just reverse that and try to see it, at least for a time, from their perspective, I think they have reason to fear that we are dominating far more of the world than they are, and probably gaining more than they are. They haven't been all that successful in many parts of the world. They've had to leave Egypt. They've not been terribly successful in Iran. Many places in the world, Cuba is really about the only success they've had in the Western Hemisphere, and it's very expensive. $3 billion a year, I guess it costs them. That's why I don't think they want another one in Nicaragua. It's terribly draining on their economy. From their perspective, I don't think it looks all that different than what we see them doing, the way they see us behaving. Yeah. Are there people up in the balcony I ought to go to, because I'm not looking up. I saw your...
Right, I'll be next.
Okay. Roger?
Well, just, I have to take exception that if you want to be even-handed, to use the same term, we have practically taken over the Philippines as much as they've taken over Poland. They have control over the government there. We've kept Ferdinand Marcos in power in the Philippines practically since World War II. In Chile, when they get a leader we don't like, we have him assassinated. How does the Soviet Union control the Eastern Bloc countries that are independent, have independent governments, except to hold that kind of thing over their head? If you get the wrong kind of government in, one that doesn't agree with us, we'll do something like assassinate your leader. That's what we did in Chile. If you're going to be objective about this, we are, the thing that is to be cautioned against is this messiah complex that we always have. We didn't take over any countries in World War II, and look what they did. That's just plain deluding ourselves into believing that we were some sort of holy, wonderful people. Without actually controlling the governments, we gained the economic spoils of World War II, which was the reason for taking over countries anyway. That's the only reason to take over a country, is the economic gain. And America got that without directly putting Americans in office. We put other people in office that would agree with us and kept them there. Shah of Iran, Marcos in the Philippines. You can list a pretty good group.
Up here.
I think it was your second statement that mentioned the example of how David left a symbol for Saul, and you kind of applied that to how we could react militarily. Could you give an example and clarify that a little bit more? I wasn't sure. Maybe a hypothetical situation?
I think because of the present climate, it would have a hard time being believed. And we'd have to do something dramatic, and then maybe continue to repeat it for a while. But one possibility, it seems to me, that we could try is to announce to the world and to the Russians that we are going to reduce our nuclear arsenal by, say, 20%. We're simply going to destroy them and invite them to reciprocate. If they do, fine. If they don't, I don't think we've lost anything. Unilaterally. George Kennan said a couple years ago, we could cut our arsenal by 50% and we wouldn't be any less secure. And it would be a sign to the world that we mean to reduce. And if the Soviets respond, great, then we'll take another step and see if they respond. If they don't respond, we're still not taking a very big risk. That's what Kennan said. I don't know if that's true. I tend to go by what I read that tends to agree with my biases, I guess. But I find George Kennan credible. You could do 10% or 20% or whatever number. I think something like that would be a sign of benevolence, of good intention, of goodwill. And it would, at the very least, I think, it would gain us some global public relations value, some public opinion value. Let people say it's a cynical move. I don't care. I think we ought to try things like that. The present course we're on is full of risks, too. So a risk of that kind, I don't think, is any greater risk. That's maybe the kind of thing I had in mind. I think a sign of benevolence would be to start talking differently in public, reducing the rhetoric of antagonism. Both sides do it. You know, we're not the only ones. But I think we have fed it as much as they in recent years. And I don't think it started up again with Ronald Reagan. I think in the last year or so, Jimmy Carter was doing it too. He was very angry about Afghanistan. He called off the Olympic participation, not Reagan, in 1980. So I don't want to put all the blame on one administration, but I remember feeling very good about what I thought were the gains of the period of detente in the mid-70s, which did come under Richard Nixon. You know, it wasn't a Democratic, naive liberal president that was doing that. It was a Republican president. So I suppose it goes in cycles. I just think right now we're at the bottom. And in Granger Westberg's model this morning, maybe that's a sign of hope, because the only way is up when you're at the bottom. But we are at the bottom in our relationships. Huh?
There's always suicide.
Yeah, there's always suicide. Back there.
I just wanted to maybe let some people here know, you talked about creating good feelings between our people and the Russian people. There is a program, and I think it's done by Ground Zero. I'm not sure if you've heard about it.
Yes, yes.
Communities are paired.
Pairing cities.
Mm-hmm. And I'm in a town that, I come from a town that has just started to do that, and we've been paired with a city in Russia, which is very common. This is a town with two small colleges, a river flowing through the middle of a certain side, and we've been paired with a very similar city.
And where are you?
Northfield, Minnesota.
Northfield, okay.
And it's, everything is in the planning stages still, but we've been paired, and we're expecting letters, and they're going to get together and write letters. And it's a wonderful, I think it's a fabulous idea, because it brings the people in the community to start thinking, heck, they're people too. And those people that create some kind of bond with a small town in the Soviet Union are going to go to the polls and vote for people that have some sensitivity to that.
I do know that program, and I commend it. You can't get a perfect match, of course. They haven't found a Soviet city that has a Norwegian Lutheran college and a Congregational college. But you come as close as you can, right? There's also, through Lutheran World Ministries, which is the U.S. Committee for LWF, a program in place now that will pair parishes in the U.S. and East Germany. The primary Christian community in East Germany is Lutheran. And it has to be done with great care, because if you just do it without regard to consequences, you can create problems for the people in East Germany. They become very visible if they regularly get mail from the West. And so it has to be done carefully and according to certain guidelines. But that program is in place. And I understand there are now 30 or 40 pairings that have been established. Visits, of course, it's mostly one way. There are some Soviet visits here, but most of it is the other way. There are some Soviet church leaders that have come here recently. But hundreds, if not thousands, of U.S. church members are going to the Soviet Union in any given year now. I think all of that is useful, as long as we don't expect too much from it. The general word that we get about Soviet teams visiting here is all of them are approved by the government. You must be aware of that. They do not let dissidents travel. They do not let travel, as a rule, people whose views they aren't sure of. So you know, for the most part, you're going to get party line stuff, even from church people. Nevertheless, I think it's healthy, because it does build it incarnates the people. It puts flesh on, and the people are no longer abstractions either way. They are living people. We had a group visiting in the Twin Cities last year through the YMCA on this end and some Soviet youth group on the other end. It was just useful to have in a church basement for a potluck, 7 Russian young adults. They define young adults up to 45, which is kind of nice. But we had sitting down at a piano in our church basement a guy who was a member of the Communist Party, and I presume not a believer, therefore, and he was belting out gospel tunes, U.S. gospel tunes. He was playing Down by the Riverside and Ain't Gonna Learn War No More, and he knew that music. And he was belting it out in a kind of jazzy gospel tune fashion. And that will be remembered for years by the people who were there. It broke down another stereotype. So there are those possibilities, and I think they're growing, and we ought to make the most of them, even though the results in terms of influencing politics in the Soviet Union is probably very, very little and very long term. But I think we need to look at the relationship in the long term and not the short term, because there is some kind of evolution going on in both societies, and I think that is finally our only hope. And in the meantime, we have to stay in touch with each other. I wanted to read one paragraph from the ALC's peace statement of 1982 that I think is useful in all of this. It is this: we recognize that the climate for public debate over military policies in the societies of the two great superpowers is not comparable. We recognize that many, including large numbers of fellow believers, within the Soviet Union and its allied states, have the same yearnings for peace that we have, that is, we in the U.S. We know that they are eager to speak against arms escalation policies of their governments, but may not enjoy the same freedom to do so as we enjoy. We agree that our impassioned call for restraint must therefore be addressed to both sides of the East-West confrontation. Nevertheless, we see that we have a special calling to address our government and our society, and special competence to influence our processes of decision-making. And then it goes on with discussion of policy recommendations. I think that's true, and we have to recognize that it's true. There is not parity between the two societies in terms of freedom for debate such as we're having here, and therefore in terms of the ability to influence the policies of the two governments. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do it in our own. That means in some sense we have to do it on behalf of both. And I think that's a unique calling of Christians, to speak not only as though we are citizens of a single country, but on behalf of the whole human family, because we do have this transnational identity that supersedes the interests of any one nation, at the same time that we're interested in have the best interests of our own nation at heart. And that's a tricky thing to pull off, that's intention, I think, always. My global citizenship with my U.S. citizenship. And we have to struggle with that. I do have copies of this for at least, I think, every couple among you, every individual. And if you're part of a couple, take just one. I think they'll go around. I didn't hear a bell, but it's 5 o'clock. Is there one last comment or question that I haven't recognized somewhere? No closing remark? Okay, then that's it. Thank you all very much.